You may know my guest today from CBC Radio's Ottawa Morning Show, Sounds Like Canada, Vision TV, and CTV Television. From 2000 to 2006, she was a member of the Parliamentary Press Gallery, APTN's first parliamentary correspondent. She left APTN for a time, and after some years working at the Assembly of First Nations, she returned where she hosted and produced Frequently Asked Questions for your Member of Parliament. And in 2012, she became APTN's Executive Director of News and Current Affairs. Karen Pugliese is an award-winning journalist, having received the Canadian Association of Journalists Charles Berry Award, the Gordon Sinclair Award, and the Hyman Solomon Award for Public Policy Journalism. She has also received the Martin Wise Goodman Canadian Nieman Fellowship at Harvard University, and I'm speaking to her today from Cambridge, Massachusetts. According to her Wikipedia page, she wanted to be a bartender, but that doesn't seem to have worked out. Maybe we'll follow up on that. Something went terribly wrong there. Karen, welcome to the show.
Hey, Wayne, how are you doing?
Right off the bat, we have something in common, because I was an aspiring bartender before I went into my more permanent career.
Were you?
I was.
I thought the reason I wanted to be a bartender is because I wanted to travel. And, you know, coming from like a working class family, like I did, I thought like, well, every town needs a bartender. So I'll just be able to move from town to town and be a bartender and make my way across Canada, the U.S., any part of the world that enjoys a beverage. And so that was kind of the idea behind that.
So let's get in our time machine, since that's kind of what we're doing now. And I'd like to go back to the late 1990s and start there. I remember September 1999, 20 years ago, the anniversary just passed of the founding of the Aboriginal People's Television Network. 20 years, the APTN now. Isn't that unbelievable?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was having coffee with Dan David on Elgin Street in Ottawa. And for people who remember or maybe don't, he was the first executive director, your predecessor at APTN.
My first boss there, yeah.
Your first boss. And I remember shortly after that time, we met up and he was telling me about this new person at the network, Karen Pugliese, he said. And I said, oh, really? That's how you pronounce that? That sounds Italian. And he says, well, it is Italian. That's neither here nor there. But I just heard, I had somehow heard of you. And so let's go back and talk about those days at APTN and kind of walk through memory lane. What are some of your recollections of that time?
Oh my God. You know, like that was such a great time to be at APTN. Like I'd like to think that any time's a great time to be at APTN, but in those days when we were starting up, it was just kind of magical because we'd never had something of our own like this before. And Dan really made us think about the journalism. You know, and you've interviewed him, so you know his story. You know, just briefly, he'd been working out in South Africa when they were ending apartheid. And he was very inspired by the idea that you could make a fresh start and you could remake journalism. And there was this great hope, you know, and this great positive energy. And we also were like naughty kids. You know, it's like I think a couple of the interesting things is coming from where we came from. We didn't understand things like class or class divisions because we don't have them. Like even though I grew up in the city, I don't think that I just understood that. So when we walked up to interview politicians, we just treated them like everybody else, you know, because our chiefs don't walk around too big for their britches, you know, so, we were standing out because we weren't rude, but we weren't polite. We walked up and just treated the minister like he was like Joe down the street. I remember Ken Williams, who was one of my partners, doing a piece, and he was referring to Minister Dhaliwal as the boss of fish during the Burnt Church coverage. And yeah, Dan David did nothing but encouraged us to be brats. You know,
somehow that doesn't surprise me.
Oh, yeah. One of the pieces that I did, and it was one of the first pieces, we went up into a community. It was Barrier Lake, and they've been divided a bit over how to handle and address the logging. And so there was a splinter group over in Cocomville. I called Barrier Lake. I told them I was going up to do this story. I understood that Cocomville was going to be blocking the road, and I was going up to cover it. And they said, it's not a story. Don't go. And they wouldn't talk to me. So I went up and I did the story. It never occurred to me not to go just because a chief had told me not to go. And they later wrote to Dan and said, we can't believe your reporter came up and talked to people in our community without our permission. And Dan said, you know, I think we're going to get this a lot.
Yeah.
We wouldn't ask the mayor of Ottawa if we can speak to somebody in Ottawa. Why, you know, there is no tradition of shutting up your people.
Yeah.
In this country. Like, we're going to have to deal with this, and we're going to have to punch through this. And so we knew we had somebody very strong leading the newsroom, and we were going to shake things up.
Yeah. That brings a couple things to my mind. And the first is, I have a quotation here from Dan. He said, we knew that if we failed, we wouldn't be failing a network, a corporation, a company. We would be failing all Indigenous people, not just for now, but for generations to come. That's exactly how I felt at the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, because we were just setting that up at the same time they were setting up APTN. And that's exactly, I know exactly what he's talking about.
Yeah, there are so few success stories, because we've been given so few chances to own our own things. And you know, like, for various reasons, you know, sometimes when we, you know, it's like, you know, like that expression, this is why we can't have nice things.
Yeah.
You know, there have been failures before we came along. And Dan, you know, Dan, that quote comes from an interview, I think, that he just did with APTN. But when he said that, it just brought back memories, because he told us that all the time. He drilled that into our heads. You can do anything here, but you cannot fail. There are people waiting for us to fail.
Yeah.
You know, and we weren't welcomed into the world of media. CBC opposed our license. The cable companies didn't want to carry us. Legend has it that they went back to our CEO and said, you know what? We're fighting to get you not carried, but we're not gonna even going to bother anymore, because in a year, you'll be gone, because they didn't think that we could make it a success. So, you know, and we felt that. And, like, you know, sometimes from some of the other reporters up on the hill, one of them said that he watched our show and he found it quaint. You know, he's lucky I didn't slug him.
Yeah. That would have been a news story right there.
Yeah.
Tonight on the news. Well, I got a quotation here from you when you were receiving an award, and you talked about, and I've heard you say this before, there are two separate journalisms. There's sort of the Canadian journalism, and there's the Indigenous journalism. I think all Indigenous people intuitively know what you mean by that. But I got thinking, and I was looking back, and because I have all these documents, and I had friends like Gail Valiscakis and Garnet Anjikoneb, who have a long history in Indigenous journalism. And it, you know, you realize in my lifetime, there was nothing. You go back to the 60s and the 70s, this stuff was all just beginning. And if you had news at all, it was just kind of stuff that was piped in from the South, and it was sort of mainstream content. So, I mean, this is still a new thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's fairly new. I mean, I think there was a little bit of work done actually inside Indian Affairs, because they had that Indian News, right? And it was really a PR rag, but somewhere in the 70s, they actually started to put Indians in charge of it. And they started to do some actual journalism, but it was very, I mean, because it was run by Indian Affairs, they were limited in what they could do. I had one speaker, and Paul Barnsley, of course, was writer and at Wind Speaker. And I can remember meeting him and getting to know him at one of the first AFN elections. And when I would sit there, I remember being in a room full of reporters, because they had their little media room, and talking to one of the reporters, and they're like, what do Indians want? And, you know, I, and we didn't have a word for like reconciliation.
Right.
I don't know. It's like, what do I want? Like, that's just too heavy a question for the morning. I remember having conversations and trying to explain things to them, like land claims, and they just didn't know because we're not taught this stuff in school. So you sit there and they go, well, people just kind of took the land, or people just came onto the reserve and just sort of took the kids. And I'm like, they didn't just come and take the kids. I'm like, yeah, they did. And they kind of rolled their eyes. And then Paul would come up. And because Paul has the authority of being a non-native person, he'd say, she's right.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden they go, oh, she is?
Huh.
We thought she was just being biased.
Right. Do you wake up now and you think, oh, you know, thank God the news is somebody else's problem? Or do you think, oh, they waited until I left to release the blackface photos? Damn it. I mean, where are you on that? Where are you? You know what I mean? Where are you on that spectrum?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Okay, I'm happy I don't have to cover the blackface photos. My God.
Yeah. But because you would, if you were doing that gig now, that would be what you would have been doing in the past few days, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think really, red face is more of like,
yeah,
sort of the Indian version of it.
And yeah.
Or our Indian version of it.
Don't worry. Those pictures are coming too.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Oh, I don't doubt it.
But yeah, you know, I guess like the question, it's like, I'm going to miss it. I'm going to miss it a lot. Like, this is in my identity. It's like leaving APTN is like, you know, chopping off my arm. But at the same time, I think it had to be chopped off. You know, I think that it was time for me to move on and let people with fresh ideas have control of the newsroom.
Well, I was just going to say, we're talking almost like this is a post-mortem or something. I mean, you're young, you're mid-career, so I'm curious to know what you are looking forward to.
Well, I mean, I think in the last couple of years I was at APTN, I was working a bit with Journalists for Human Rights. So we get back to this, like, there seems to be this constant African theme that comes up with APTN. And, you know, so once again, I was working with Journalists for Human Rights, and Rachel Polster, who's the executive director there, she's been doing a lot of programming in First Nations communities here to train people to be citizen journalists or to have the skills of journalists and encourage them to become journalists. She also runs many programs over in Africa where you have emerging democracies, which is a nice way to say dictators are stepping aside. I guess that's the polite term for it. But, you know, she grew up there in Africa, and she's a Caucasian woman. And she came to understand, as she bounced around to Africa, what racism really looks like. And she really got to know a lot of the culture there. And so she could see it in a way that I couldn't. And she wanted to send me over to South Sudan. And she just felt like there would be a connection there. And when I went over, oh boy, was there ever. Like, it's just amazing how much you can have in common with somebody who's halfway around the world. But there's colonization, there's land issues, there's conflict. We're a drumming people, we're a singing people, we have similar senses of humor. So there's just so many connections that we had. And they asked me to speak, because they declared peace just a few days before I went. So they were having a conference on how to cover the peace, and they asked me to talk about doing journalism post-reconciliation. And what we were doing in Canada and how that might, you know, so people in South Sudan could think of how they should move into a post-conflict journalism. And I had given, like, no thought to this, and I really should have. Executive Director of News and Current Affairs at APTN.
Yeah.
You know, because really the TRC just said, like, chin up APTN, SCOTUM, keep going. You know, it's like, Caden. So, I mean, this really got me thinking. And I started to have my first thoughts about it. And I'm thinking, what is the role of journalism now? Like, you know, what should we be doing? What should we be thinking about? And how should we be doing journalism differently? So really, that's that's what my year at Harvard is about. And I'm looking at other truth and reconciliation commissions. I'm looking at post-conflict societies, and I'm trying to understand what media and education mean in trying to come to terms and heal a society.
Yeah, those are big, heavy topics, aren't they?
Yeah, so, I mean, like, a lot of times I'm joking, but, like, in the back of my head, like, there's a lot of stuff that goes on in there that keeps me up at night.
Yeah. So your work is going international, which is interesting. That's similar to Dan David. He spent some time in South Africa doing, kind of asking similar questions, right?
Yeah.
I think, you know, what happens, and you can understand it, is so you've got a media system, and then some indigenous people come in, and they kind of run that system, and they do the same sort of news the same sort of way, and then at some point they realize, well, wait a minute, you know, we're just doing what we already had before, but now there's, you know, darker faces, I guess, on the television. But you do kind of have to go through that phase, I guess, of really being reflective about what you're doing. But that's not a new thing now. I kind of feel like what's happening is there's just so many young people now, right, that are coming up. And they're brilliant, and they're doing really good work. And if we can just open the doors, particularly a lot of young Indigenous women, I mean, if we can just open the doors, I think just the fact that they're there and they have a different perspective is, and is, don't you think that's inherently transformative, right?
I think Dan spent a lot of time thinking about exactly that question, and I know you know this, like how, like what is Indigenous journalism? What does it mean? And I think over the years that APT has evolved, like we're not doing necessarily the Dan David vision of news. Like it lasted for a lot of years. And then, you know, there was turnover and people came and went. And when I came back, I realized that I was dealing with a really different generation of journalists. We had a lot of people who'd come on board. We still had people who'd been there from Dan David years. And so it was kind of trying to marry this new generation's vision into what we were trying to do. I think, you know, they see the world a bit differently. So I kind of had to be open to following their lead. Most recently, I think I had this opportunity to work with this incredible young woman, Natasha Reamer. And she's not a journalist. Every now and then we bring people in that don't have a background in journalism. We had brought her on to be interviewed on a show as a subject because she is part of Millennial Scoop and has spent a lot of time in university thinking about her own experiences, but systematically what needs to be improved in the child welfare system. And so she came on to talk about that. We didn't have a summer student lined up. And so I said to Cheryl, who was the executive show producer, but now is now is the new Karen at APTN. She's the executive director now. But I said, why don't we just bring her on as a summer student and let her do like a project, like whatever she thinks she needs to do to express what she thinks needs to change about the system. So she decided to do a podcast, and she and I worked really closely on that in my last month there. But it's all her. You know, I helped her out. I would listen to it and tell her, I don't understand what you're saying here, or could you be a little clearer? Why are you saying this? And, you know, but she really put that together A to Z. And it's that thrill of working with young journalists that I think is really special. I'm looking forward to that when I go to Ryerson.
And what's your sense of the audience? Because I know this stuff is studied, right? You know how many subscribers you have. Clearly, a lot of grassroots people are watching the show. I'm just curious because I kind of looked into it a bit. I didn't get a lot of information, but what was your sense of the audience that you were speaking to? And did you have kind of an imagined audience, or you had a real sense of that?
Yeah, we have an imagined audience. Because I always say it's the COCUM up in the community. So that is who we're talking to, somebody we respect, somebody who does not have all day to read reports and figure out what they mean, because they're very busy with their lives and they need us to be able to explain to them in a respectful way what's going on without talking down to them, you know, like, and things that are relevant to their lives, not things that we think are important. So you have to sit there and you have to imagine what's going on in the communities right now. What are they going through? And so, like when we did the show, Nation to Nation, which is a political show, my one instruction for that show was, don't be like power in politics. Now, I grew up in the Ottawa bubble. Yeah. I love power and politics. Politics is a blood sport to me. I'm part of that north of Queensway crowd.
Yeah.
But it's not for everybody, and that's not what I wanted Nation to Nation to be. When I left APTN in 2006, and I'd gone over to Vision TV first, and then I went over to AFN. And I remember the national chief was getting a meeting with the minister. And there was all this fuss in the office about what he should say and who could be in the room. And this was clearly a special occasion where they were going to meet. And that was the first time, you know, 6 years after that I realized what kind of power I'd actually had as a journalist.
Yeah.
Because I could walk up and talk to the Minister of Indian Affairs any damn time I wanted to. And I didn't even have to be nice to him.
Yeah.
And he had to talk to me. And if he didn't want to talk to me, then we would, you know, take video of him running away, and that didn't make him look good. So, you know, like you, with that in mind, you know, when we were doing the show Nation to Nation, I was like, okay, I get it now. There are people out in our community that will never have the chance to ask the thing that's important to them.
Yeah.
And so we've got to be that voice. So I don't want the show to be a reporter just having a smart conversation with a politician, and we're all supposed to watch that smart conversation. I want that conversation to be, you know, what is it out in the community that you need to know, or that's impacting you right now, that we can get your question to the people in power, that you're not going to be able to ever get an answer on your own. Like, that's the service that show needs to offer. And we tried to do that when we had, you know, during the last election, when we had the leaders on. We didn't come up with our own questions. We took questions from our people, and we made sure we had a mix of Métis, Inuit, First Nations, North, South, East, West, four directions. And we took their questions and put them to the leaders.
Yeah, I love that format, by the way.
No, thank you.
The Roundtable, WayneKSpear.com.
You were doing the parliamentary gallery thing, so you were living in that world.
Yeah, and I was right out of university. Like, I literally just graduated.
You were a young person, so yeah, absolutely. And I heard somewhere that your beat was Ontario, Quebec, Nunavut, and the Northwest Territories, which I found pretty hilarious.
<That's right. laughs>
That little piece of real estate there. But, I mean, let's be honest, interviewing politicians, sometimes you just want to pull your eyes out or your hair out or whatever it is, right? It's like, it, after a while, it kind of gets to you, doesn't it?
You know, I like, yes and no. There's different things that happen, and you have to constantly be vigilant. I feel like Harry Potter, constant vigilance. I think there's one thing that happens is that you do get to know the politicians, and you get to know what they do. Andy Scott, who is Minister of Indian Affairs, Yeah, and, you know, him and Jim Prentice both passed away, and were both ministers of Indian Affairs that I knew. So, you know, and you get to know them, and you get to like them a little bit, and you have to watch that.
It's the people you're surprised the most with. Like, I met some Harper people, really nice people, and then you're supposed to go on TV and kind of kick them in the kneecaps. But you know, that's the little, I almost want to say, little dirty secret of Ottawa between journalism and the kind of political establishment, is that you do, if you stick around long enough and you move up high enough and you become the Andrew Coyne or the Mike Duffy, you know, your kids go to the same schools and you meet together socially and you find yourself at barbecues and you belong to the same club. And yeah, so there's that behind. I'm not inferring this about you, Karen. Mm-hmm. But you know, it really becomes kind of it's a show. But in reality, yeah, you're buddies, you're on the same team kind of thing.
Well, you know what? Let's talk about that, because this is something that doesn't get talked about a lot. And I love this conversation. Yeah, so I'm this young reporter. And I guess the first thing that you kind of learn is, as you're dealing with different politicians, you get a sense, because you're asking them questions all the time when you're working that beat, you get a sense about how they're stepping around your questions. So Andy Scott was somebody who was like, well, you're asking me that question, but what I'd like to talk about. And so you get him doing that a few times and you realize, oh, that's how he's going to get off the question. So you interrupt him and you say, well, I know you'd like to talk about something else, but I'd like you to ask the question that I asked. And in a weird way, like, this relationship develops while it's adversarial. They actually get to like you because you're fair and you're tough, and they kind of admire that. And there are these different things that go on in Ottawa, like there's a prime minister's party. I went to it once. I was young. I was excited. I had never been close to a prime minister in my life, and I wanted my picture taken with a prime minister, so I went to the gardening party. I never went back. They have that special event every year, like that press gallery dinner, and we went to that one year, and we never went back. We started realizing that I think Dan actually forbid us to ever go back, but I'm not 100% sure about that. Later on, some of my reporters were asking if they could attend these dinners. When I became a manager, I said, absolutely not.
Really?
You need to avoid those at the plague. Yeah, no garden parties, no liberal mixers. Do not go to these things.
There's two kind of schools of thought on that. George Orwell had a rule, which he would never go out socially. If he was going to go to a dinner or a cocktail party or something, and he knew there was somebody there that he had to write about that week, or that he thought, I'm gonna have to nail that person somewhere down the road, he just wouldn't go. He avoided any kind of social contact. But then there was the other school of thought, which is that, you know, somehow I can make those things, I can square that circle. I can be social with them. I can even like them, but I can still be objective. And people fall down on both sides.
You know, I couldn't. I couldn't have a relationship with somebody and feel that I had the distance to tear them down in public. I think I would do it.
Yeah.
You know, because it's my job. But the closer you are, the harder it was. Like I said, I liked Andy Scott. But there was a community, Gold Bay, that had been under third-party management for God knows how many years, like a dozen years. And while they're under third-party management, they're paying this third-party manager, their debt actually doubles.
Yikes.
You know, things were going wacko wrong in that community. And we found this out. We found the paperwork. And I went back to ask the minister about it. I told him the interview was about Gold Bay. They knew what I'd been working on. Like, I didn't give them details, because you don't. You give them the topic. You don't give them the questions. And so, but I mean, I'd clearly been covering the story and going back to it and revisiting it for a while before I sort of found my smoking gun. So I didn't tell him I had the smoking gun, because you don't. And, I went up and I hit him with this. And I also hit him with the fact that the, contract for that third party manager had gone out untendered.
Mm-hmm.
They were supposed to be tendered, a contract that size. And, I remember asking them, it's like, does it surprise you that your staff up in Thunder Bay are breaking every rule in the book?
Well, that's fair.
And
right?
he had a staged answer, right? Like, where he's like, well, third party management is something that we do. And he just repeated it again. And then, you know, the third question, he was desperate to get out of there. And so I recorded the questions, and you could hear him not answering my questions.
Yeah.
Which is what you try to do when you're in that situation, and they're just going to keep repeating their media line. He went back, and his staff told me that he bawled them out for a good hour after that interview. He was so upset.
I mean, are there any interviews you did that kind of stick out, or for any reason. Good ones, interesting ones, maybe not so good. Any stories there?
I think the most surprising one I ever did was with Terry Brown. And she was leading NWAC at the time. And it was missing and murdered women was just becoming a thing. You know, there'd always been missing women, but that Amnesty report had just come out with, at the time, an anecdotal number of 500 missing and murdered Indigenous women, with half the cases unsolved. So it was the first time there was actually, you know, something that looked like data. And Terry Brown told me her sister had been murdered. And it was the way the interview went, because I just said, oh, well, can I interview you about that? Like, will you talk about that? Because for the head of, you know, the president of NWAC's own sister to have been murdered, and it be an unsolved murder is a story, and one that I hadn't heard. Like, nobody had done that interview. So I went back, and she had photos of her sister, and we were talking, and she's saying that her sister had gone into the doctor, and she said she had a headache. And the doctor asked her sister if her sister had been drinking. And she said, I don't know if my sister was drinking or not, but he told her to take Tylenol and go home. And a few days later, she wasn't feeling any better, so she went back to the doctor and, you know, said that she had a headache. And again, the doctor said, well, have you been drinking? And he sends her home. And so I'm wondering at this point, like, what is she saying? Is she saying the doctor killed her because the doctor didn't examine her? Like, I didn't know where she was going. So her sister dies. And when she went up to see the body, her sister was beaten so black and blue that she could barely recognize her. And that was how her sister went into the doctor, beaten black and blue, saying she had a headache. And the doctor had asked, have you been drinking? And I just the way the interview, like just the way the story came out, I think I nearly like fell over when I realized what she was telling me. That one always stuck with me. And it's such an important story about how women get treated.
And it's one of those, it's shocking, but it's not surprising, you know, really. Because those attitudes are out there.
And the more you dive into what's happened to the families of missing and murdered women, the less surprising it became.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You think, oh, that's the stuff we're still dealing with.
Exactly.
You were kind of at the helm for some really interesting times, because there was the inquiry there. I'm looking at the time frame. When you came on in 2000 to start, okay, so that would have been, that's when the whole residential school, the settlement agreement, the lawsuits, that was all happening. That was the big issue, right?
Yeah, I covered a lot of that, a lot of stories, a lot of testimony from survivors. Not inside the, because it wasn't a TRC, and the testimony that they were giving through the ADR process wasn't open, but as they were trying to change the system, up on the Hill, there was a lot of survivors going in and telling their stories to committees.
Yeah. And then the TRC, Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Were you at AFN at that point? 2006, you came back to APTN, right? No. See, I get all messed up here.
2006, I left. 2015, I was back, and I think it was 2006 to 2008. I was at AFN. So interestingly,
okay,
wait
a minute.
Yeah.
Why AFN?
Oh.
Explain
it
yourself.
It was there. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, you know what?
Why did you leave? Why did you leave? Why did you go to APTN? Why did you come back?
Yeah, it takes a Haudenosaunee interviewer to be brave enough to ask that question. Nobody's ever held me accountable for that. And people know it. I actually thought, you know, the first time Jesse Brown interviewed me, I thought, like, I think he doesn't or didn't know enough about Indian country. Maybe he still doesn't. So he's still learning. But I thought that's what he was going to ask. He was like, how can you leave the newsroom when you've been painted? Which is a fair question. Yeah. It's a completely fair question.
So?
I just ended up unemployed is the answer to that. I had gone over to Vision. I knew that I didn't necessarily want to stay at Vision because I couldn't figure out how to make it work. I had to commute out to Toronto, but I was hoping that we could work something out that I might be able to stay with them, but they canceled the show. So I came back to Ottawa and I was unemployed and I was a single mom and I was terrified. And I applied for a job at Native Women's Association and I didn't get it. And I applied at AFN for a health communications officer and I got the position. And again, it was, I remember going up and telling some reporters that I was now going to be working as a communications officer, and they physically recoiled from me. They honestly took two steps back as if I turned into a snake or something. Yeah. But having said that, I got a really good perspective, being inside Assembly of First Nations, of how that organization and politics and policies work. Because it how a bill becomes a law is a public process. How a intervention becomes a policy is something else. So in the end, I think it was good for me. I didn't feel like there was anything that compromised me morally or anything, but it was a problem. Like, I did have to distance myself. My first job back into journalism, I didn't cover anything Indigenous for a year, because I wanted to give some time and space in between myself and that job.
Here's what I want to talk about. We were just on a show together. I mean, this isn't really it. This is just something that kind of made me chuckle. So we were on a show together this week, past week, and we were talking about the election. And I thought I'd ask you at some point if you had any thoughts on this election. But we were on the show in the United States. It was an American show. And it's called Native America Calling?
Native America Calling, yeah.
So it's a call-in show. And I was all geared up. I thought, oh, this is going to be exciting. It's going to be fun. Karen and I are going to go on this show and people are going to call in and we're going to talk about the election and we're going to hear about what America is thinking about the Canadian election. And one person called. And he said something to the effect that it's important to vote, mm-hmm. which I agree with. You know, if you want to change things, they certainly have to get out and do that, I think, in the States. But I kind of chuckled about that because we did that show together and one person called in. But you had a lot of great things to say. So I know you're thinking about the election. You're a political junkie, aren't you, Karen?
I am a political junkie. I totally am.
You're a nerd.
I am.
Well, so am I on that kind of stuff. So, I mean, I'm not even going to point you in a direction there. If you want to say anything, what you're thinking, what you're observing, and this isn't your job, I guess, now, so you can kind of be more free-ranging, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A couple of things. Having left APTN, first of all, when we went to get the leaders on the show, and I knew that year, because we had never had leaders sit down and come on a show and talk to us, not from the big parties, like Elizabeth May will do it. And usually the NDP leaders will do it, but not necessarily during an election. But they will give you an interview at some point during the year. The TRC had just come out with its report and everybody's saying, reconciliation, reconciliation. I'm like, oh my God, a moment on your lips, a lifetime on your leadership. You have to come on the show now. You cannot not talk to us. And so we had Elizabeth May, who's always great. We had Mulcair come on and we had Trudeau come on and we did not have Harper's, just people didn't even call us back. But it wasn't easy to get either Mulcair or Trudeau on. there was a lot of back and forth. And finally, the way we got Trudeau was that they had called us to go attend an event where they were going to make an announcement that was very positive for Indigenous people. And so they wanted APTN there. And I was talking to one of his communications people, and I said, we'll send somebody, and we'll accept the sit-down interview that you're giving us, but it does not replace our request for the debate. And that hadn't even made it up. I had to explain to him that we put in the request because it was even on the radar. So I said, we're sending Cheryl McKenzie. And I said to Cheryl, make sure you ask him on camera if he's attending the debate. It's kind of to say yes or no on camera. And so he promised on camera that he would do the debate. It turned out not to be a debate because there's that weird thing that happened where Mulcair wouldn't attend a quote-unquote debate unless Harper was there. But we did get like a sit-down town hall kind of interview with each one of them.
Yeah.
So that was good enough. So what I'm wondering about this election, is reconciliation over? Are they going to do the interview with Indigenous people again? Or are they all going to forget about it? Like, is it over? Because that is so important. We're the only people that are going to sit down and ask the questions that are on the minds of our people and ask them in the way with the right amount of pressure that needs to be put on.
So that you were talking about 2015 there. Do you have any kind of inside track onto what's going on in 2019? So what's the APTN coverage looking like now? And are they all not answering the phone? Is that where we've gone back to? Do you know?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what the leaders are doing. So that's what I'm wondering. I did get a chance to run into Justin Bright, who's going to be the new executive producer in Ottawa. He just got that job because Fran is now the new show producer and Cheryl's the new executive director. So when I left, everybody kind of, like, there was kind of this promotion, like a series of promotions up the ladder.
Right.
So I was talking to him. He's, like, lined up his pundits, and they're thinking about how they're getting out into the communities at this point. So I don't know if the leaders are going to be there. To me, that's a huge signal, one way or the other, especially whether Justin Trudeau, as a sitting prime minister who promised APTN that he was going to be accessible and promised Indigenous people if he's going to sit down and do an interview. The other one is the Conservatives, because Harper didn't. And I'm betting Andrew Scheer didn't. We've never had a leader, even interim leader, come on to one of our shows. If the Conservatives want to get Indigenous people voting for them again, and there was a time where Indigenous people voted Conservative, they are going to have to talk to Indigenous people. I mean, you cannot just sit there and keep snubbing your nose at people and then wondering why they don't vote for you. It's pretty obvious.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if we've exhausted that topic. I mean, there's lots to say about the election, but I am curious to see where the dust settles. And is it going to be a conservative minority or a liberal minority? That's how I'm seeing it now.
No, that's how I was seeing it. I thought that maybe it could be before the election was called, like around this time last year, I was thinking conservative minority because they had time to build up Andrew Scheer and do something with him. And they didn't. So I've noticed that, like, they actually, like, font him or super him in television, like when they put your name up on a font or put your name up on the screen. You know, like, we call that fonting or supering. So I they do that with their leader because people don't know who he is. Tell him this is Andrew Scheer. This man talking in this commercial, that's who he is. That will be your conservative leader if you want to vote. So, you know, like, they could have probably done a lot to promote him, get him out there ahead of the election. They didn't do it. So that made me think, ooh, liberal minority. And now with the blockchain thing, I just don't know how that figures in. I don't know if people are going to say, oh, you know, I'm kind of hearing this. Oh, it was a long time ago. Wasn't he just a kid? And I'm like, dude, he was 29. He was a teacher. And people are like, oh, I didn't realize that. So some of it's not translating out. The party faithful is going to find a way to forgive him. But in between, you know, how people feel about that, like those voters that aren't sold on liberals and aren't sold on conservatives, I don't know how they figured out that contradiction.
Yeah, it'll probably come down to what percentage of the voting public was kind of leaning, maybe I'll vote liberal, or sorry, maybe I'll vote NDP, maybe I'll even vote green, but maybe I should vote liberals, just, you know, be more strategic and make sure the conservatives don't win. And then this comes along, and now they're thinking, you know what, I'm going to vote for the NDP.
Yeah, I wonder. And then there's always that question. It's like, well, should I, like, is that a wasted vote? Can they win? There was that brief time where it looked like, you know, the NDP could form a government federally. But, right now, Jagmeet Singh hasn't been the kind of charismatic leader that they need to lead that party to a win. So, yeah, it's hard to say what people are going to do with their votes if they thought they were going liberal and they're deciding to change their mind.
Well, what I'll do is after the day after the election, I'll re-edit this so that we predicted it perfectly.
We just have to say every scenario.
That's right. We just read them all out from the teleprompter and they'll say, wow, that Karen Pugliese is brilliant.
Yeah. Congratulations to the Rhino Party for their win.
Yeah, exactly. The Rhino Party takes it all.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got the commentary bug. I think you're good at it. Yeah, so I'm thinking there's going to be a radio show somewhere soon, or you're going to land somewhere. Where do you have a sort of dream job, a dream gig?
Well, I'm going to be teaching it at Ryerson, so that's going to be,
So you're going to be in Toronto.
Yeah. I'm going to be moving to the Six. Yeah.
That's awesome. Cause as you know, that's where I am, at the center of the universe. right. Well, that's great.
Yeah. So, I mean, that will be like my base, but there's some things that I want to do. I had the idea, you know, with Natasha's podcast, by the way, everybody listen to Natasha Rainer's podcast. But one of the reasons that I did that is because I wanted to try to see if I could bridge a voice in between kids in the millennial scoop and journalism and telling their stories, and maybe them helping by telling their stories to other kids in care. And so I kind of have these like little projects that I think having a job like that lets me take on. And you know, I still get to publish and I still get to write. So I'm always gonna have the bug to be a journalist. I love being a journalist. It's awesome.
I've heard people say it's not what I do, it's who I am. And yeah. And APTN has now presence here in Toronto. They're getting into radio, which is exciting, and getting into other markets and other media. So maybe something there. I don't know. Would you go back and do something, a gig there? Is that even on the horizon, a potential thing?
I don't think so. Not on the horizon for the next few years. David Moses, who I know you know, he's had me on as an interview at Element FM. He and I used to work together at APTN back in the early days too. He was the first Ottawa correspondent and I was his researcher. And so we had some fun reminiscing there. And it's great to see him on the air and having a relationship back with like APTN's sister company again. I don't know if I'm going to be back as a journalist, but I think if I do have, like, if I come across something interesting, I might, you know, ask them to publish it. I could see myself working with them. They're doing great work, cutting edge stuff.
That you do. We didn't say much about Harvard. We don't need to get into that, but you're at Harvard, and that must be a hoot.
It is amazing. Like, it is such an amazing opportunity. And it's not, I mean, I was kind of worried that it'd be kind of snotty or something. It's actually not. Everybody's really nice. So they do offer this fellowship every 2 years in Canada, and I'd encourage people to apply for it. And I'd also encourage, if anybody's young and listening to your podcast and wants to be a journalist, be a journalist. Do journalism. It's the new red power.
Cool. Karen, thank you so much for being on the show. It was a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me. It's so great to talk to you, and it's so great to like have a conversation with another Indigenous person, because so often you go on and you have to stop and explain everything, like, you know, and it's like we can just talk. Like, we know what it is, right?
Yeah,